Today on One Question, should schools fully reopen in the fall?
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
This is Tim DeLoisio. We've got Paul Testa. And this is One Question. Our one question this week is, should schools fully reopen in the fall? And I think we've got interesting perspective on this. I'm both a parent of school-age children and work in a middle school this year, elementary school last year, as an educational support professional in Massachusetts, where things are going relatively well as far as coronavirus cases right now. Feels like things are under control. We're starting to open up. Paul, on the other hand, you're in a space that's definitely not doing so well.
Not doing so well. 15,000 cases today in my lovely state of Florida.
And so I think it kind of sets the stage for an interesting discussion about what does September or a late August, an early September look like, or what should it look like for our schools? Should schools be fully opened, right? Should students be going back with proper precautions, but fully in person 100%, or some of the other options on the table that we'll talk about today, a virtual only model as things get under control with the pandemic in certain areas, or a hybrid model where we're lessening the number of kids in a school at any time, but providing some in-school and some virtual learning simultaneously. So I think we'll get into all that, but I think it's pretty clear right now where our president stands.
We want to reopen the schools. Everybody wants it. The moms want it. The dads want it. The kids want it. It's time to do it.
Do you think that's truthful, Paul?
When you were a kid, did you ever really want school, Tim?
Well, this is very true. I think you would think that this is like the best of the best world for kids. But I can tell you from, you know, having been through the shutdown, I think, you know, in March, April, and, you know, May, June, virtual only classes in the state of Massachusetts, that after a couple weeks, the kids were ready to go back. They wanted to go back. They were tired of where they were. You could see the mental strain that I think is the biggest worry for, you know, a lot of people. And I think the biggest argument for opening the schools is the mental health and the socialization of our children, and the fact that the education is better in person than virtually. All those are legitimate points, Paul.
Definitely legitimate.
But, yeah, I don't know of anyone that's saying we shouldn't go back to school because kids don't need to be with other kids, or that kids don't need to learn effectively. It's a risk-reward conversation, right? And right now the risk, especially in certain hotspot areas, is way out of control when there are ways that you could potentially, you know, mitigate and plan your way around, you know, the school year. Do you think when Donald Trump says, you know, moms want it, dads want it, I mean, what's your feel in Florida as far as the, you know, the general consensus of what, you know, parents are wanting?
Moms want it, dads want it, aunts want it, uncles want it, grandparents want it. It's, can you do it? Like, that's the thing that we're coming down to. We all want it. We all want life back to normal. It's, can you effectively transition to sending everyone back to school and do it in a safe way? And I don't know if that, I don't know if we have an answer to that yet. Do I think we could? Yeah, we could, but we have to go through many steps before it's essentially safe to do that, in my opinion.
So you would think, right, that as a governing body, that the, you know, the president and his task force and the Secretary of Education would all be thinking through how to support districts and states and people making those decisions around how to phase in appropriately school. But instead, from Betsy DeVos, we get this.
It's clear our nation's schools must fully reopen and fully operate this school year. Anything short of that robs students, not to mention taxpayers, of their futures. And their futures represent our nation's future. So it's not a question of if, it's just a question of how.
Okay, question of how. Do you think she's got a how, Paul?
I don't believe she has any how. And that's therein lies the problem. It robs students of a very essential part of their development and social interaction, going to school, participating in sports, learning in a classroom setting. It definitely does. But how? Again, give me the answer to how, or give me a plan to how, and everyone will feel a little bit more comfortable about the decision.
Well, and what I find really interesting, we'll hear it in a conversation between Dana Bash of CNN and our Secretary of Education there in a little bit, but part of the how, or all of the how, actually, it, from the secretary's perspective, is being left up to the individual districts to decide with, you know, how are you going to do it? Now, I think that there is, it's interesting, when you think about that, on its face, I don't think that's a bad assumption to layer in, that each district is, you know, within each state is confronted with different hurdles with regards to the state of the pandemic in that area, the state of the students in that area, what the you know, the level of ability to, you know, whether you're in an urban environment or in a rural environment, the digital divide is clearly a large issue. We saw lots of children, especially lower income, being left behind because they didn't have internet access or enough, you know, digital resources, computing at home to keep up with a virtual only model. Lots of kids fell off the map entirely. I think it's frustrating to hear the president and others be extremely critical of what virtual learning was. I think he called it terrible. What virtual learning was at the beginning of the pandemic and when schools shut down, given that schools shut down overnight, there was no, this wasn't something that was, you know, foreseen at all, planned. It really, even in the grandest plans, you know, disaster recovery plans for, you know, schools, etc., I don't think this scenario had played out realistically, right? There were no, you know, there was no playbook to go by. So the first, you know, few months were figuring it out, right? How do you adapt a curriculum to students in a totally new setting? Without having put together the framework to support all that, doing that all on the fly while teaching the kids with all the uncertainty that was never going to be a positive learning environment. Now, did it get better as you roll through April, May, June? It did get better. Was it as good as it would have been this upcoming, you know, end of August, September, if we went into the new school year in a virtual model? No, I don't think it was as good as what it could have been. That's what these last couple of months should have been about, right? And I think for some districts, it has been planning for a virtual only model that is more successful than the one that they left, right? But I'm shocked that the government didn't help guide that process at all.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm shocked. I'm, you know, if it was any other administration, I might be shocked. But
fair point.
This seems to be the status quo, and you know, you can put it all on the local level to make decisions, and I think that should be the school in Nocatee, Florida, that where I am. Should probably make a different decision than the school where your kids go to school, because it might be affecting different things. But what should never be an issue, I'm sorry, but what should never be an issue is tweets or threats coming from the government saying, like, if you don't open, we're going to pull the funding because what's the point? The federal government, you can't. So now you have people making decisions based off of the threat of losing funding that they're going to get from the federal government.
And you know what's interesting is when you look at funding for public education, I believe I saw a stat that said today that really 90% of the funding for education does not come from the federal government.
Sure.
It comes from states and districts.
And my taxes.
So really, like, it's even worse, I think, in that it's 100% political and posturing, and not the threat isn't really going to change anything. The threat of pulling funding, because that funding isn't going to make or break, the process. I don't know. I mean, you can hear in this quote, Trump clearly is going to exert whatever power he can to get schools open.
And we hope that most schools are going to be open. We don't want people to make political statements or do it for political reasons. They think it's going to be good for them politically, so they keep the schools closed. No way. So we're very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open. And it's very important. It's very important for our country. It's very important for the well-being of the student and the parents. So we're going to be putting a lot of pressure on open your schools in the fall.
So use political pressure to stop political statements. Mind-blowing. Really, really don't know what to say to that other than no one is making a decision. There's no person at a state level, I believe, that would lean towards closing schools is doing that to make a political statement or to win votes.
It's the exact opposite
of what, right? Yeah.
The person using the political, clout is the one that's trying to push people into the schools. That is purely a political decision because it's very black and white, right? The schools are going to open and everyone's going to go. Okay. That makes a firm stance that's good for politics, but it's just not realistic, right? The decisions the statements that I think voters don't like are the ones that are gray and in the middle where reality happens. And so when you hear people that are unsure of the exact plan but are taking in lots of information, to me, those are the people that are probably making rational decisions. I mean, I'll give Charlie Baker here in Massachusetts as an example. He has come out and said that the goal is to get students back in school and fully open if it can be done safely. If we can meet the CDC's standards for safety and for health and all the protocols that they've laid out, which are not a lot, to be quite honest, but there's a checklist. If we can do that, and if in doing it, we don't see like rises in cases. Like there's a bunch of criteria, but that's the goal, and I think that's fine. But he's also open to the fact that Massachusetts has the pandemic in a good spot right now. We are opening up the rest of the state slowly and in smart ways. And should a spike occur, I'm sure they will quickly act to, back off all those decisions. So to me, that's all rational. You can say we're going to try and open the schools and it doesn't have to be a political statement and it doesn't have to be the end all be all black and white, statement that the president and secretary of education are making right now.
But this is where, yes, decisions should be made at the local level in this regard, in regards to the school. But this is where leadership becomes such an important factor. Because someone like Charlie Baker is not going to care if the president is mad because he closes the school because he sees a spike coming. And he decides, listen, we have to shut down the schools. This is coming from kids going to school and infecting teachers or whatever it may be. We need to rein this back, get it back under control, and try again at another time. Where I live in a state where the governor is afraid of the backlash from the president and just won't do it. And, you know, you're looking at a state where you're having 200, 300 cases a day. I'm at a state where we're having 15,000 cases a day. It's running much more rampant down here. We trust our local leaders to make a decision, and this local leader is taking his direction not from the data that he's seeing in the state of Florida, but from the voice coming out of Washington, D.C. that's telling him to do certain things. And that's
that's how you get things like this, Paul.
Mm-hmm. But I'm confident if you can do Home Depot, if you can do Walmart, if you can do these things, we absolutely can do the schools. I want our kids to be able to minimize this education gap that I think has developed.
So asinine. I mean, absolute gibberish. Tim, when we, because I go to Home Depot 5 days a week for 8 hours a day. Do you?
I go to Walmart for 5 days a week. Yeah, 8 hours a day, yeah, 5 days a week. Right. So, I mean, we've got that. A little different, but you know. Yeah.
I mean, because it's such a good comparison. And this is the same governor that's been touting at his press conferences for the last week, when these numbers have specifically gotten significantly out of control in Florida, has told us that being inside air-conditioned places is really triggering the spread, because people in Florida, when it's hot out, they like to be in air conditioning, and air conditioning's not our friend. So last I checked, all the schools in Florida, right? Number one, in the district that I'm in, are completely overcrowded, because it happens to be a great school district, and you build a school and it's completely maxed out, and they're in portables, I guess is what they call them, almost like the day that they open, because there's just too many kids.
They're modulars up here. Yeah. They're called.
How do you manage that? Number one, and schools are air conditioned, right? So now you're putting, you can't socially distance.
Or worse, Paul, or worse, mm-hmm. like up, you know, a lot of the schools around here, they're not.
Right.
And the windows don't open, and they're poorly ventilated, and there's no circulation of air, and everything's static. So, I mean, to your point, yes, it's bad to be in an air conditioned, you know, where, you know, it keeps cycling internal air throughout. Up in, you know, a lot of the schools up here are much older. And I mean, I'm sure the school that you went to school in when you were in elementary school might still be holding classrooms today.
I'm sure it is in Rhode Island.
And so, mm-hmm. yeah. And so if you think about that, it presents a whole nother issue. I mean, let's put it this way, Paul, if the virus gets into the school, it's not going anywhere. It's populating it. So you got to stop it at the door, because you're not going to stop it once it's in. Now I know, actually this brings up this is a response from Dr. Dana Grayson, who was on her Twitter, kind of was answering some questions. She was an Ebola specialist, but she kind of addresses, I think, the beginning of a thought about why it might be okay to consider, you know, going back to school for younger kids.
The evidence appears to suggest is that kids who are 10 years old and younger appear to have a much lower risk of getting infected and even transmitting transmitting the virus to somebody else in the school setting. So that's potentially some good news about reopening of schools. But there's some really important caveats. Number one is a lot of that information is gathered from countries who, first of all, controlled the pandemic. And so they did.
So we'll stop there for 1 second. So I think a really interesting point. So yes, and this is quoted, I think I looked in the Massachusetts Department of Education put out some guidelines. And they kind of quoted some similar facts and numbers, specifically out of, I think theirs was out of Austria, possibly, but that younger kids don't get the disease as much. They don't transmit it as much. The symptoms aren't as severe. The in-school environments, they haven't seen the blow-ups of the virus that they've seen in churches or weddings or, you know, those other types of similar places. I mean, I just think that using that data, I mean, that data is interesting, but it doesn't seem like that's end-all, be-all to make this type of decision on.
No, I don't think it is the end-all, be-all to make this type of decision on. And that's the thing, you know, the data that we are getting and analyzing and making decisions is early stage data. Like, this is still, even though this feels like it's been forever, it's still very, very new. And I mean, things are constantly changing. Like, you know, whether it be, you know, it lived on services, it doesn't really live on services. It was
droplets, aerosol,
like whatever. See, like, we're still learning everything about this virus. And I mean, she says it right there, like the kids, they don't, you know, they don't transmit it as much and they don't have the same effect. Great. That's the data we have now. But what's the data when we pulled all these kids out of school? What's the data when it's not and they're all in school? Like, what is that going to give us information on?
Well, and I'll also tell you, Paul, like, I could say that if you think about, go back to mid-March when all the kids got pulled out of school, I know my kids and our friends' kids, you know, while we were still going out to grocery shop or to run an errand or to do things to keep the house running, guess who didn't leave the house for months, like 2 months?
The kids, yeah.
Didn't leave our yard. Yeah. We as adults, we had to take some risk. But I can tell you that the kids did not take any risk. Mm-hmm. So what I don't know that you have, like, if you go back and say, oh, did we have good data in mid-March when this was just starting to flourish? No, we didn't. And so you can't rely on the data from what kids did after that, because their behavior was so unlike what it will be like if they go back. I think the other thing that Dr. Dina Grayson mentions there is that the data is from places that have controlled the pandemic, right? So it was already in control. So maybe you could look at Massachusetts and say, okay, we can use that data a little bit to drive our decision-making, but then go to Florida, go to Arizona, go Texas, places that, you know, Southern and Western schools start a few weeks earlier than the Northeast. You're two weeks away from the school year starting? 3 weeks?
Yeah, like mid-August.
4 weeks? Like mid-August, okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but it's right around the corner. And, you know, I don't know what you're hearing down there, but it doesn't sound like the pandemic is going to be in control anytime soon.
No, they're saying right now that the peak is, I think August 9th is what they're saying the peak in Florida will be for the virus, based off of the data that they're getting now. But, you know, I mean, some decisions are being made. Parents are being forced to make a decision, I think by Friday, on if they are going to do full on board, go to school, like brick and mortar, go to school, or do virtual learning. And if they do virtual learning, here's the caveat. I talked about the overcrowding of the schools that we have here. If they choose the Florida virtual learning, they have to unenroll from the school that they're assigned to, which means future ramifications for that child are, they might not be able to go back into that school. They might have to go to another school and new friends, which is another whole world of when we talk about the development of kids, that's a traumatic thing, is when they have to go to a new school and meet all new people and potentially lose their friends because a parent didn't trust where they are, or wouldn't feel comfortable, and made a decision that, you know what, I want my child to do virtual learning. They have to commit, I think, to a complete semester of that, but they do have to unenroll from the school, and there's no guarantee that they'll come back. That's a terrible decision to put on parents to make when we're at,
absolutely,
we're not even at our peak. We're in the middle of a hot spot, and it's going to be made by this coming Friday coming up.
I mean, that seems crazy to me that to put it on parents and make them feel like now they're not being supported by the school system, right? I mean, is that once again, if you think about who's driving that policy decision, it's not likely the superintendents or the teachers or the principals, right? The people that then have to deal with all this. It's the governor and on up that's driving a lot of those types of policies. And it, yeah, it, we haven't even talked really that much about teachers and administrators and the toll that this is all taking on them. It's really unfair. I mean, quite frankly, if you look at the private sector, employees are getting supported to work at home, right? I mean, this is the, like, I think people have gone above and beyond in the private sector to support their workers. There's Family Medical Leave Act for small companies. People can take up to, I think, 12 weeks at 2/3 their salary. If your kids can't get into daycare or aren't in school or daycare right now, there's a lot of things that have been built up that, you know, and employers have, I think, generally done a really good job of being understanding about parents needing to work from home, or just employees in general, but parents that are working from home that also have kids there. It's like that they're not just pretending that's not happening. They're accommodating as long as the work's getting done. It's just getting done differently. Doctors are doing their well visits via telemedicine, Paul, right? Sure. I had a physical schedule. They said, no, we're not going to see you. Telemed only. Okay. But teachers, no, you guys get back to school and you guys take the brunt of all the negativity that's going to come from the kids, from the parents, from, you know, like it's all going to get funneled onto their laps. And they're in a situation where, you know, they have to go back to their families after having been out of quarantine in the classroom all day. I could speak for friends of mine that, you know, they've been as, you know, quarantined as everybody else during this time, right? And now you're going to go back to school and it's like you're out there, right? You can't, you know, so let me give this example. My father is, you know, had cancer, immunocompromised, right? Once the kids and I go back to school, I don't know that we'll be able to see him unless we take a 2-week at home quarantine.
Sure.
But, you know, like, and so imagine now, and he lives, you know, stayed away, but imagine a grandparent that lives with you, for example, that you take care of. How do you manage all that?
I grew up in a three-generation house. Like, my grandmother lived with us my entire life growing up. Like, that's more common than what people think. I mean, those are the issues that are happening. Listen, I hope no kid is affected, or as minimal as possible is affected by this virus. It's not necessarily that's the danger of going back to school. It's the teacher that you said, that's, you know, certainly not gowned up and wearing a face shield and wearing a mask. Like, I can't imagine that. They're not going in there like an outbreak.
Well, we will be wearing masks, Paul.
Yeah. So
that'll be a requirement. And I did see, at least in our district, they'll be supplying, I have heard, I should say, that they'll be supplying face shields. I don't know what the requirement to use them will be. It's interesting. I mean, PPE is a big discussion because, you know, you already have burdened school budgets and they're going to have to now allocate some to PPE that they didn't have to do before. I mean, you could go into the whole, what does the school actually look like? I mean, they've got to redo the classrooms. They've got to figure out lunches. They've got to figure out busing. Busing is going to be a disaster, yeah. Right? I mean, like,
but how
busing
do you
already
do
is, tr- like,
that's
is a, difficult. That,
again, this is what we keep coming back to. How do you do it? Like, if you have a school that holds, just say 800 kids, and you have 800 kids, and you have to put that school that held 800 kids, everyone was on top of each other nonstop.
Yep.
So how do you socially distance in a school and still teach 800 kids? Like, it's just not really possible. It's like saying, like, okay, you know, let's open up Fenway Park and have, you know, 34,000 people in there and let's everyone socially distance. It can't happen.
Well, and the truth of what will happen is it's going to be figured out on the fly. Because until everyone's there, your best plans are, I mean, they're just that, they're plans, right? Like, you think this is how it's going to go. You put real kids into that environment, and now all of a sudden, you're figuring it out as you know, each day. Like, okay, you know, we're going to need to take a 10-minute mask break. How do we do that? Everyone's got to wash their hands. That's going to take a half hour out of the day. If we're queuing to go down the hall, do you need to stay 6 feet apart? How do we, like, I can't even get them to stay in a straight line.
Right.
Now you want me to get them, just keep this many squares and blocks in between them. And that's in an elementary school where you have some control. Now go to a middle school where people are changing classrooms every period. And, the hallway is already chaotic. Like, I don't even know how you manage that. I just come back to it. The smarter thing to do in the face of all this uncertainty about, and we haven't even mentioned, we're talking about the first spike in Florida, the anticipated September, October, November traditional flu season second spike that many scientists say is going to be worse than what we've seen so far. Well, if that's something that's potentially out there, wouldn't it have made sense for everyone from the start to say, we're going to do virtual only through the end of the year, and we're going to make that be the best experience we can. We're going to figure it out. We're going to work out all the kinks over the summer. We're going to have a curriculum that works for that. And if the numbers are better than we're expecting in October, here's the criteria that will start to phase people into the school, as opposed to the exact opposite, which is throw everyone in there. And then when the numbers start to go out of control, try to then scale back. Everything's backwards here. The other thing that I just mentioned that I haven't heard a lot of is, what are the criteria for moving from one phase to the other? I saw my cousin is in a district in Maryland, and they did have an interesting phase in plan of how they were going to slowly phase groups of students into the school over the first 4 weeks of the school year. They weren't just going to open it all up. It was going to go by grade, by alphabet cluster, and in 2 or 3 week blocks. And there was a whole complicated plan, but at least there was a plan and it had phases. But what I didn't see outlined was, what was the criteria that said this phase was a success and we can move on to the next? In Massachusetts, for the private sector, or just for just life in general, for our shelter, Charlie Baker had phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four. And there were numbers that had to get hit, regarding hospitalizations, deaths, percentage, positive test rates, etc., for the state to move from one phase to the other, right? And if there was any, five consecutive days of negative numbers, everything rolled back a phase. Well, that sounds like a plan. I'd be all for that. I don't see any of that information in the back-to-school plan. So that's going to be up to the districts and
right,
to decide, I guess, as what, Betsy said earlier. I just don't know how they make those decisions.
But this is where, in ordinary times, leadership from the top, meaning the federal government, should be giving guidance on what the schools, and should be giving benchmarks, and the CDC should be giving benchmarks to all these areas in regards to what needs to happen for it to be safe. And that's what we're lacking. We're this whole entire time, we've been on a hope, regardless of anything, with this virus. It's just been hope. Open up the economy again and hope for the best. And no plan for the best, hope for the best. It's taking that approach now with the school system, which is just putting a lot of people, in my opinion, is putting a lot of risk into something that should be better, more manageable. It should be manageable risk, and there's nothing manageable. They're not managing the risk.
No, not at all. I mean, when you mentioned leadership at the top, let's hear from, here's a nice extended cut from our Secretary of Education with Dana Bash on CNN, and I'm sure we'll cut in and out of this a few times as we react.
To what happens if there's an outbreak? What are experts telling you about the appropriate level of transmission for a school before it has to shut down?
Okay, so here's the question. We just asked it. What are the criteria? What's the criteria for action? Well, that's a reasonable question. Let's see.
reopen the schools for us.
Well, I know that that's an area that the CDC is helping to provide further insight into. I can't, as a non-physician or a non-medical expert, tell you precisely what to do in the case of one child in a classroom or five children in a classroom. But the key is every school should have plans for that situation to pivot and ensure that kids can continue learning at a distance if they have to for a short period of time.
You're the Secretary of Education.
Right. So I don't have a plan, but they'll have a plan.
They should have a plan.
I don't know what the plan is, but I know they'll have one.
What happens if it faces an outbreak? You know, there's really good examples that have been utilized in the private sector and elsewhere, also with frontline workers and hospitals. And all of that data and all of that information and all of those examples can be referenced by school leaders.
But I'm not hearing a plan from the Department of Education. Do you have a plan
for what students and schools should do? So, schools should do what's right for their students and for their situation.
No, so the thing that's just so alarming about that is just how abundantly clear is that they don't have a plan. And like one of the things that you said in the first clip that we did before we paused was, she can't speak to it because she's not a doctor. She certainly has access to a lot of data and doctors that can give guidance and should be able to tell the leader how to articulate that guidance out to the school districts. So it's clear that they're not even, taking that effort to get the information. Again, it's open up the schools. That's what I want. That's what we want. Everyone will be happy. Open up the schools and hope for the best.
That's certainly what their plan sounds like right now. Let's hear. Maybe she's got some nuggets for us, Paul. Let's hear where this goes.
There is no one uniform approach that we can take should take nationwide.
But can
because
I just
the
ask
needs
you,
of a school in the city of Detroit are very, right. In my home state, in the city of Detroit, would be very different than that of a school in the Upper Peninsula
exactly.
of Michigan.
And that's the point. That's completely understandable. Mm-hmm. But you are arguing over and over that they should handle this on a local level. But at the same time, as the Secretary of Education, you are trying to push them to do a one-size-fits-all approach, which is go back and reopen schools. You can't have it both ways.
I am urging all schools to open and to be providing their students a full-time education.
Alarming.
So even when cornered, mm-hmm. right? Just no plan, and She got caught right there. Well, I mean, I thought that was great interview.
It was a fantastic interview, and kudos for that and asking the hard questions, which a lot of times people seem to be afraid to ask this administration, but the questions were asked. And yes, I mean, there's parts that I agree. A school district in Detroit is different than a school district in Alaska, and how that needs to be approached. But again, guidance on how to approach those things. And we talked about earlier, political pressure and or making political statements. Like if a hard decision needs to be made to shut the school or shut the school system down in a certain area, that needs to be supported and championed from the top, not ridiculed
right.
and punished from the top. Because like you said earlier,
totally agree.
It's a last case scenario that these school districts want to do is pull that plug and say no and go to virtual learning. But if they have to, for the safety of the community, it should be applauded. And it should be
well, and if you look, I mean, just today in Hong Kong, they pulled the plug on schools. Now, the cases were fairly under control. They saw an isolated cluster of new cases, and they aggressively went and pulled the plug on everything. And they were applauded on the world stage for that. In the same moment that we're hearing these conversations come out of our leadership. And so, I mean, you could see if you look across, across the globe, where students are going back to school, the things have been handled much differently. And that's what's allowed them to get back into the classroom. And when things go south, with respect to the virus, they're aggressive. I don't have great hope, Paul, that's how universally it'll be applied in our country right now. I think there are pockets of states that will do, will do it well. But I think that there are others that will unfortunately fall way short.
Right, and that's the issue is when there's a washing of the hands and saying it's been for the whole virus. It's been down to the state level to make state decisions, and some states are doing good, some states are doing bad. But you know what? Some countries, pretty much everyone, but not named Brazil, Russia, or the United States of America, are doing really well with this virus because they had a national effort towards mitigating the virus. We have not, and we're paying the price.
Absolutely. I think this quote from Dr. Ashish Jha of the Harvard Global Health Institute in an interview with, I think, CNN also really rang true for kind of what I think could happen should we follow the president's orders and just open the schools right up.
You can open up schools anywhere you want. That's really not the debate. The question is, can you keep schools open? Can you prevent massive outbreaks among teachers and staff and kids? And if we don't do the things the CDC is asking for and more, the schools will all be shut by Columbus Day, and they will be shut for long periods of time. That's what we have to avoid. And we can't bluff our way through this. We've got to let science drive it.
And I think that's the unfortunate reality of where we're at if we fly blindly into this. And once again, I just want to go back to saying I'm not in favor of kids being in school to start the school year. I'm in favor of doing it the right way in the right places, right? I think in Massachusetts, we can experiment with, kids in the classroom and as long as we have the right criteria and the right phases and the structure built to do it smartly and react appropriately, and that we're not just like, we're going in and that's it. I think we're in a position in our state that yes, it's reasonable to expect that kids could be in school successfully. That's not an outrageous statement. It's not without risk at all. And that should also be under great consideration by all the people, kind of setting the plans in motion. I think that there will be districts in our state that, are very conscientious and, once again, do it excellently. And I think, so I feel like I'm definitely a proponent of less risk. I do feel like, though, in Florida, it would be a non-starter for me right now. It would be virtual only. Well, if I was in your, if my family was down, living in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a decision, again, that a lot of people would make here. But again, this thing has been so politicized from the start, which is sick in its aspect that a pandemic is politicized. Like, if you wear a mask, you're against our president. If you don't wear masks, you're for our president. Like, we went through that whole stage. There are a lot of people, and I don't know what it's like. I mean, I know how, from the people that I talk to up there, that they take the pandemic pretty seriously. But, there are a lot of people that don't believe that this is a big deal. That they don't believe the pandemic is an issue. When you look, they throw things at alcohol-related deaths versus this. Here's the thing: you choose to drink alcohol. You don't choose to get this virus. Like, and regardless of what the science that is there and the science that you need to believe in, because science is real, is this affects our most vulnerable population worse. Like. And, you mentioned your dad and, the cancer battle that he did and, just how I can't even imagine what goes through your mind, like, when you see him, like the precautions. Well, it's the same for me. My family's down here. My parents live 5 miles from me. I've probably seen him 4 times since. So our Mother's Day, Father's Day, and a couple other times. You know, just because I don't want to be the person that transmits it to them and know that I've done that, even though I don't know. I mean, I don't believe I've had it. I have not had any symptoms of anything of that nature, but every single time I go out, I know I'm putting myself at risk for it. And then, and since I can't readily know if I have it or not, I just don't want to take that risk with my parents. And like, it's just no way to live. And that's how, so I guess my point is like, we
all. So now you're going to force that on families and teachers and parents and kids, and that you take all that choice out of their control, because potentially science says that you can get away with, you know, with it with younger kids because the virus doesn't transmit as much. Oh, we didn't even get into college in this discussion, which I guess maybe we'll hold for another time. But you know, it's the argument. I mean, even middle schools and high schools, that argument that the data doesn't support why you should be opening up middle schools. It's really elementary, right? Yeah. So, but once again, you'll apply that statement of fact broadly to, you know, advance your cause. If you are a proponent of getting everyone back. Now, I also want to say that I know there's so many layers to this conversation that we won't touch on in as much detail as maybe I would have wanted. But like, one thing is, yes, there are parents that need to have their kids in schools because they need to go do their jobs, right? Like that, like there are whole segments of the population where it is untenable to have schools shut down economically for them. Right. Well, once again, a good supportive government could have made decisions that said, if you have, as an example, if you have school, elementary school age students, and you are sent back to work, this is your stipend. This is your, you know, your kind of bailout. Right. Instead of just applying it broadly to everyone, you could have certain criteria that allow those people to stay home if they have to, or things. And I feel like there could have been policies put in place to mitigate some of the economic side, specifically for parents that need their kids to be out of the house so that they can do the work that they need to do. Sure. Right? That shouldn't be on the education system to solve. It makes it overly complicated for, you know, getting kids back to school to layer in that fact. That should have been solved by other policy. And, you know, unfortunately, it was not. So but I did want to mention, you know, that there are clear, and we talked to the digital divide a little bit. There are clearly limitations with virtual learning there. You know, we barely touched on mental health. So many big picture items that continue to make this a very difficult conversation to have. But you weigh that all against the risk. And I think this is what it all comes back down to, Paul. Right now, the risk numbers in most of the country would tell you that the risk is not worth what you're opening up for. And, you know, unfortunately, that'll be something that has to get proven out, I guess.
Well, because that's the approach. I mean, we're going down that path of opening up the school system. So, yeah, we're going to see. Hopefully it works great. But if it works bad, we're going to see it. Instead of mitigating that problem and doing it smart and making informed decisions on how to reopen. Even the scenario that you said with the parents that have to go to work, you know, maybe you open up schools slowly for those type of kids, you know, that, you know, they're the ones that go and you do virtual forever. And you just, I mean, virtual for the others that can have a parent at home to be able to be with the kids.
I think there were ways from a policy perspective to think through the problems critically and come up with answers that, you know, in an approach that just wasn't taken at the, you know, at the government level, right? The, you know, this is kind of out of the school districts and the principals and the teachers, and like, that's all logistics and operations. The policy stuff that could have supported changes in all that that thought wasn't done and planned correctly, and thought through how could we do things differently? How could we support being conservative and not being, you know, too, you know, risk tolerant? And I think part of the problem was when school let out, Paul, things were trending in a better direction, right? It was, if you think back to June, you kind of had a little false positive. The states like New York and Massachusetts and Connecticut, in New Jersey, that had big spikes were coming down. Florida, other states hadn't spiked yet. People were deep in their shelters and hadn't, you know, the sheltering was just starting to open like in Georgia, and we weren't seeing huge spikes, you know. So that was the time when all these decisions need to be made. And maybe there was a little false sense of security that caused, you know, a certain course of action in decision making. And maybe we got trapped because of that. I don't know. But I will say this to anyone out there that's faced with the challenge of, you know, having their kids in school or being in school themselves. The most important thing is that you speak your piece, right, about what you need and what you expect and what you want for your children, and have those conversations with the, you know, the school committees, with the districts, with the principals, with the teachers, but with respect that they don't have all the answers, but that collectively maybe we can make the best of the hand that we're dealt, and that if we're creative and we, you know, and thoughtful, we can come up with ways to navigate through even the murkiest of path. And so I think that's where now it's on to the people that are going to have to face those challenges to put some of the negativity aside and, you know, and try to make the best of the situation in front of us. I guess that's really all that, you know, when I look at what I can do personally, right, that's all I can do. So I guess that would be what I would hope for others at this time. So that's a tough question, Paul. I think this is our hardest question yet.
This was a tough one question indeed, because it's one question that leads into 27 other different questions. And it was a good topic. I enjoyed it.
And we'll lighten it up. We've got some, look, the Twitter is hopping, Paul. I'm getting questions thrown at me left, not so much right, maybe just left. But I do have some questions. Once again, you can always ask us questions on our Twitter. I'm going to get it right this time, Paul. One Question Podcast, at One Question Podcast. You can follow us at Instagram, on Facebook. You can find us, you can ask us all sorts of questions, but we'll only answer one each episode. Once again, you've got a question, we've got answers. That's been One Question Podcast with Tim and Paul this week. We'll talk to you again soon.
The teacher is teaching the golden rule, American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass, working your fingers right down to the bone, and the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell, the cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat, you're fortunate if you have time to eat.